Well, the life of Thomas. Now, Thomas is a very interesting person. I suppose most of us know Thomas as the doubter. And I suppose perhaps a slightly better way of describing Thomas would be not just that he was the doubter, but that he was Thomas the pessimist. Because that was really the fundamental sort of character that Thomas had. He was essentially, he was by nature, a pessimistic person. How would you describe a pessimistic person, by the way? What do they tend to focus on? Yeah, pessimistic people always see the problems, don't they? They always see the negatives. They're always uncertain about things in life. Now, you see, the thing is this. We can't help what we are by nature. And some of us, by nature, tend to be more pessimistic than optimistic. Of course, pessimists always think they're really realists, don't they? But, in fact, they are pessimists. They focus on the negative rather than on the positive aspects of life. And remember, the whole story of the life of these disciples is it doesn't matter what our background is. The truth is designed to change us, irrespective of where we've come from. Now, it's interesting that the life of Thomas occurs exclusively, or the story that we really have on Thomas, occurs exclusively in the Gospel of John. Everything we really know about Thomas as a person occurs in the Gospel of John. Because you see, the key to the Gospel of John is the theme of God manifestation. That's what John's Gospel is all about. And God manifestation is all about how the truth is designed to work in us to change our character. So John finds Thomas an interesting person to write into his story because his gospel is all about learning to manifest the Father, not ourselves. And that given the strength of the truth working in us, we can do things that we maybe originally have thought that we couldn't do in our own strength. And remember, as we said before, Christ didn't make any mistakes in the men that he chose to be the 12. And he chose Thomas to be one of them. So although Thomas was a pessimist, the Lord knew that he was a man that if he could only allow the secret of the truth to work within him, that he would be able to overcome his nature and become a brave warrior for the truth. Well, let's come to John chapter 11, where the story of Thomas first starts, and just see if we can pick up the spirit of the man here. In John chapter 11, we read from, remember the story of Lazarus here, we read in verse 7 of John 11 that after that the Lord said to his disciples, let us go into Judea again. His disciples say unto him, Master, the Jews of late sought to stone thee, and goest thou thither again? And that's quite true. In fact, if you come back to the Gospel of John and to chapter 8, we're told in the very last verse of John chapter 8, it says that the Lord, having spoken to them, it says, then took they up stones to cast at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple, going through the midst of them, and so passed by. Actually, you notice an interesting connection between the last verse of chapter 8 and the first verse of chapter 9. Verse 1 of chapter 9 says, and as Jesus passed by, he saw a man which was blind from his birth. You see the repetition of the phrase passed by. You see the last verse of John 8, and going through the midst of them, he so passed by. John chapter 9, verse 1, and as Jesus passed by, he saw a man which was... It's quite interesting, actually, because you see, Jesus is trying to escape, isn't he, from those who were endeavouring to kill him. But there was, even though he was trying to escape, there was something at the very moment that he was trying to get away, there was something that compelled Jesus to stop, and that was a man in need, a blind man. And so that little phrase connects John, the last verse of John 8 to the first verse of John chapter 9, and shows us how that the need of that person aroused the compassion of Jesus at a very dangerous moment in his own life. So they'd taken up stones to stone him, John 8:59. Now, over the page in John chapter 10, you'll remember in verse 30 that Jesus had said, I and my Father are one. And therefore verse 31 says, then the Jews took up stones again to stone him. So this is the second time. They took up stones again, says the record, to stone him. So no wonder when we get to John chapter 11 and in verse 8, when he says, let's go back to Judea again, his disciples said, look, Master, the Jews of late sought to stone thee, and goest thou thither again? Judea was a very dangerous place at this time for Jesus. But it wasn't just for Christ, was it? It was therefore a dangerous place for the disciples to be of Christ. Because by virtue of their association with him, and of the antagonism that was being aroused against the ministry of Christ, therefore the disciples themselves were now under threat if they came into the region of Judea. So the disciples weren't very happy with this suggestion. And the surprising thing about this story is that of all the disciples to rally the others together and say, it doesn't matter, let's go anyway, it's Thomas. Now fancy that coming from Thomas. You see verse 16? Then said Thomas, which is called Didymus, unto his fellow disciples, let us go also, or let us also go, that we may die with him. Now you see, Thomas is a very strange mixture. Here is a man who has deep doubts, but yet despite that doubt, he displays on this occasion strong courage. Here is a man of little imagination, and yet who has enormous loyalty to his Lord. And of all the disciples, it would have been Thomas that was probably the last one we would have expected to have rallied all the other disciples around Christ and said, come on, let's get going. Now, do you think Thomas said this because he was by nature a brave person? You know, did he say, well, come on, let's go, we can face it? Oh, not Thomas. Thomas was scared stiff. That's what Thomas was like. Thomas saw all the problems. Thomas could see the stones. And yet it's Thomas, of all the disciples, that said, well, we're going to go anyway. In fact, I'll tell you how Greens translates verse 16. See if you can capture the spirit of Thomas's words here. Then said Thomas, which was called Didymus, unto his fellow disciples, let us go, even we, that we may die with him. Or as Young's literal says, we may go, we also, that we may die with him. You see the spirit of Thomas? He actually was very frightened of what he'd suggested. There was no bravery here. He wasn't doing it out of raw courage. Thomas wasn't a courageous person. But over and above his fear of the stones of the Jews was his love for the Lord. He saw the danger, but he felt that they should be loyal. It's a tremendous spirit here of a man who by nature really didn't want to go into Judea at this time. Shows the relationship that he had to Christ. But there's a key word that we want to underline in verse 16, and you need to take a pencil and just do this. It's the word die, because that's a negative word, and that's the mark of the pessimist. And every time that Thomas opens his mouth and speaks in the record, you'll find he always speaks in the negative. Thomas doesn't realise that, of course, but he does. Every time Thomas opens his mouth, he always speaks in the negative. And here's the negative word here. Let us also go that we may die. Thomas saw the danger and the negative side of life. And you see, the problem was this. Really, what Thomas had done here was a marvellous thing. It was a marvellous thing that he felt the danger threatening them all, and yet he also decided that they ought to be loyal to Christ. But he didn't quite understand what to die with Christ meant. Because he didn't understand what sort of death that Christ was going to himself. He lacked understanding of the principle of sacrificial death. You see, Thomas saw death as defeat, not triumph. Thomas saw death as negative, not positive. Thomas saw death as loss of life, with no gain on the other side. When Thomas says, let's go that we may die, Thomas only sees disaster, not good. Ah, Thomas, you haven't yet understood what sort of death our Lord is going to. And God willing, this very day, aren't we, we're going to focus on the fact that the death of Christ, far from being a negative thing, was the positive triumph of all his labours. Thomas didn't understand that. Never had any comprehension of death in a positive way at all. Well, that's the first time that Thomas occurs in the record. John chapter 14 is the next time that Thomas speaks. He only appears three times, but they're just enough to give us a sketch of the spirit of the man. In John chapter 14, of course, we're in the upper room, and we're told in verse 1, "Let not your heart be troubled. Ye believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions or abiding places. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there ye may be also. And whither I go, ye know, and the way ye know." Thomas says unto him, "Lord, we know not whither thou goest." See the negative word there? It's the word not, isn't it? We know not whither thou goest, and how can we know the way? Now, the fact of the matter is, they did know the way, and the disciples ought to have known the way. And if you come back to chapter 13, which we've already looked at, we know the way that Jesus was going. Because in chapter 13, in verse 33, the Lord said, "Remember, little children, yet a little while I'm with you, ye shall seek me. And as I said unto the Jews, whither I go, ye cannot come, so now I say unto you." And so he was going on the way of obedience to his Father. Now, it's interesting that the way of obedience, of course, the way that Jesus was going on that the others couldn't follow at this stage, was the way of death. But it wasn't a negative death, it was a positive death. Because the Lord was going to say, verse 34, "A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another as I have loved you." And that was all going to be shown in the way Jesus was travelling on. It was the way of love, wasn't it? It was the death that was prompted by a love that he had for his disciples. "Greater love hath no man than this, than that he lay down his life for his friends." The way that Jesus was going on was the way of submission to his Father's will, and the disciples ought to have known that. So you see, when in John 14 and verse 5 Thomas says, "Lord, we know not whither thou goest," well, they ought to have known, because Jesus' whole life had been spent to demonstrate that way. And the death that was coming was going to be the final positive outworking of obedience to his Father. Jesus had spent all his life putting to death the flesh. And when he finally hung upon the cross, it was going to be the positive declaration of all that his life had stood for from beginning to end. But you see, Thomas didn't understand that. Thomas could only see death as a negative thing. Isn't it interesting? We're on the subject of death again. The Lord's referring to the way of his death. And that sort of subject fascinates a pessimist, doesn't it? Morbid things. Pessimists love that sort of stuff. But Thomas didn't really see the positive side of the Lord's work. You see, pessimists are those who see trial as negative. Whereas the truth of the matter is that trial is a positive agent, isn't it, that God brings upon us in developing our character. It's not how pessimists see it. Why did this happen to me? Why have I got these problems? Why have I got all these worries in life? A pessimist never sees trial as a positive thing. Well, I'm sure there's some reason why this problem's happened. I don't know what it is, but maybe God's trying to teach me something out of this. Now, what can I learn? What principles are there from the Word that could affect how I should react to this problem? Well, you'll remember that the record says in Mark's Gospel that when the Lord was finally taken in the Garden of Gethsemane, all the disciples forsook him and fled. And I can just see that moment where they all tumbled helter-skelter down the Mount of Olives, dashing between boulders and trees and into the inky black darkness of safety away from the soldiers and the torches and the lanterns and the staves. And of all the disciples that ran away that night, I can just imagine that of all the disciples, it would be Thomas who probably was affected the worst. Because you see, Thomas was the sort of person when a disaster struck in life, his whole world would feel as if it was shattered. You ever had someone like that? Who's a pessimistic person and something really terrible happens to them? They don't just go down, do they? They go really down. They really hit rock bottom. And it was as if Thomas's whole world had come to an end, because the disciples never really had understood, had they, the sacrificial death of Christ. And Thomas was one of those ones who would have been deeply affected by that. Now, what would a pessimist do when his world is shattered? What's the likely thing for a pessimist to do, do you think? Blame it on everyone else. Sulk. Yes. Can you think of another word for that? That sounds a little bit sort of a wee bit childish, which may not, they may not, but what's another word for sulk? Yes. Brood. And how do they brood? How does a pessimist brood? On their own. They retreat into themselves and brood on the miseries of life and on why everything's gone wrong. Now, do you want to see Thomas there? John chapter 20. Here he is. Here's our pessimist. All by himself, brooding in a corner. And that's the worst possible thing that a pessimist can do. Now, in John chapter 20 and verse 19... it says, then the same day at evening, being the first day of the week, when the doors were shut, where the disciples were assembled for fear of the Jews, came Jesus and stood in the midst and said unto them, peace be unto you. And when he so said, he showed unto them his hands and his side. And then were the disciples glad when they saw the Lord. Verse 24, but Thomas, one of the 12, called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. Now, the record doesn't say why Thomas wasn't there, but it seems to me to ring true that that's exactly what we would have expected of a pessimist. Because that's what people do, you see, that are of a pessimistic nature. They retreat into their own little shell and brood. You know, that's the worst possible thing for a pessimist. You think a pessimist ever solves their own problems by brooding? They get worse and worse, don't they? And you see, there's a good lesson for all of us here, because, by the way, we can all be Thomas at times. There might be some people who by nature are pessimistic, but all of us have moments in our life when we're a bit Thomas and we're a bit down and we're a bit... You know, the worst possible thing for us to do is to withdraw into ourselves, because we'll never find the answer to our problems inside ourselves. Do you know where the answer lies? When we've got problems and we're down and we're depressed, the answer lies, John chapter 20... among the disciples. That's where you've got to be. In the ecclesia, that's where you'll find the answers. In the company of other people who are positive in the truth, that's where the solution's to be found. Never by yourself. Why wasn't Thomas with them? And so if you feel that you've got a tendency to pessimism or to feeling depression at times, don't ever leave the meeting. You'll never find life's answers away from the meeting. You know, the people are like, I'm upset, I'm not happy. Something's been said to upset me, I'm not coming to the meeting. I don't think I'll go. Well, you'll never solve problems that way. The answer lay with the disciples. Well, they must have said something to Thomas, because at least in verse 25 they'd said, well, they passed the message on, because verse 25 says, the other disciples therefore said unto Thomas, Thomas, we've seen the Lord, but, oh, there's our little word there. Well, welcome to the pessimist again. You see the word but? That's a negative word, isn't it? But he said unto them, except, oh, there's another negative word. And then he said, except I I shall see in his hands the print of the nails and put my finger into the print of the nails and thrust my hands into his side. I will not believe. You see all those words of the pessimist there? The whole of Thomas's speech here is in the negative. He focuses absolutely and completely on the negative, and it all starts with the word but. There's always a but with Thomas, isn't there? You ever come across someone like that? Doesn't matter what you say to them, there's always a but. Yes, but. But what about this? But what about that? Some people are built that way. Truth's designed to change us, you see. Now, you see what Thomas says in verse 25. But he said unto them, except I shall see in his hands the print of the nails, and put my finger into the print of the nails, and thrust my hand... You see what Thomas is doing? He's building up a whole lot of things. He says, I want this, and I want this, and I want this, and I want all this extra evidence. They've already told him that they've seen the Lord. Thomas says, that's not good enough for me. I want this, and this, and this, and this added as proof. Now, don't you think Thomas wanted to believe that Christ was raised? Wouldn't Thomas have wanted to believe that the Lord was alive? Why did Thomas make all these extra demands above all the other disciples? Why did he do that? Well, you see, it was because he was a pessimist. And you see, he was by nature a negative person. He wanted to believe, oh, he did. But Thomas had the evidence of Christ's death. He'd seen a man dead on a stake. And he'd seen it with his own eyes. And he'd seen a body taken into a tomb. And he'd seen the stone rolled over that tomb. Thomas had seen that. He says, it's not that I don't want to believe, but I've seen the evidence that this man is dead. And he believed his own eyes and ears. That's what pessimists do. They believe their own eyes and ears. What I've seen, what I know. Now, if you want to prove to me that that's wrong, that's fine, but you'll have to have mighty good evidence. I want this and this and this. He just didn't want what the other disciples had done when they said that they'd seen the Lord. He wanted to add touch, didn't he? He wanted to add touch to sight. And you see what he says at the end of that verse. It's very interesting. You see how this is the mark of a pessimist? He says, except I shall do this, and do this, and do this, I will not believe. Now, do you know what Thomas should have said? What he should have said was, well, if I can do this, and I can do this, and I can do this, I will believe. Isn't that what you should say? But that's not how a pessimist works. A pessimist says, except I can do this and this and this, I will not believe. Thomas focuses on what he won't do, rather than on what he will. That's the mark of a pessimist. You see that phrase there, I will not believe? Bullinger tells us that it's an emphatic negative in the Greek. It should be rendered, except I can do these things, I will never, never believe. That's what Thomas said. I will never, never believe. And you know another thing that Bullinger says about that emphatic negative? Bullinger says it's quite interesting that every single time that emphatic negative, that double negative, has ever been used by someone in the record, they've never ever done what they said they would do. Anytime someone's ever used that emphatic negative, they've never actually done what they said they would do. And by the way, that's going to work its way up in this story as well. Well, at verse 26, and after eight days, again, his disciples were with him, and Thomas with them. Well, at least Thomas has learned his lesson. He's back in the meeting. He's starting to come back to them. Well, that's a good thing, isn't it? At least he's back where he should be. He's back amidst the disciples. He's back in the ecclesia. That's where you'll solve life's problems, not out brooding on your own. And again came Jesus, and the doors being shut, he stood in the midst and said, peace be unto you. Then said he to Thomas, Thomas, reach hither thy finger, and behold my hands, and reach hither thy hand and thrust it into my side, and be not faithless but believing, or of course as the word really means, faithful, which is what the word believing means. Be not faithless but faithful. And you see what the Lord did in verse 27. He used the language of Thomas. Thomas said, unless I put my finger into the print of the nails and thrust my hand into his side, I will not believe. Jesus walks into the room. By the way, the door was shut, so that was interesting, wasn't it? He walks into the room through the shut door and says, Thomas, reach hither thy finger and behold my hands, and reach hither thy hand and thrust it. That was Thomas's own words. Jesus uses Thomas's own words back to him. How did Jesus know? Imagine what that would have done to Thomas. That the Lord, who he hadn't seen yet alive, had knowledge of the very words he'd spoken. Thomas, I know your thoughts, is what the Lord's saying, isn't it? I know your thoughts. And verse 28, Thomas answered and said unto him, my Lord and my God. And what a strange thing for Thomas to say. He said, my Lord and my God. Where did Thomas get that from? What made Thomas say that? Zechariah chapter 12. Zechariah chapter 12. Actually, chapter 13, I suppose, just for connection. Remember in chapter 13, verse 6, one shall say unto him, what are these wounds in thy hands? So Zechariah has this prophecy about the man with the wounded hands. Isn't that the very man standing before Thomas? The man of Zechariah? Come back to chapter 12 and verse 10. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplications, and they shall look upon me whom they pierced and mourn for him. But you see the change of pronoun. They shall look upon me whom they have pierced, says God, and mourn for him as a son. Have you read Zechariah 12 verse 10 carefully? God says that the nation pierced him, God. They shall look upon me, whom they've pierced, and mourn for him, the son. And Thomas said, as he looked upon the man in front of him, the man of Zechariah with the wounded hands, whom the nation had pierced, he says with a flash of inspiration, my Lord and my God. Because what he saw in the man standing before him was the man of Zechariah, who was God manifest in the flesh. They shall look upon me whom they pierced and mourn for him. God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself. And with a flash of inspiration, I believe, Thomas, his mind went back to the pierced man of Zechariah and saw the one who was at once both God and man, and said, my Lord and my God. What a remarkable thing. That was a marvellous thing for Thomas to say, wasn't it? A flash of inspiration in that moment as the wounded man stood before him. Now come back to John 20, because here's another remarkable thing. Because you see the paradox of what happened here. Because you see, Jesus came before Thomas and showed him the wounds in his hands. He showed him the tokens of his sacrifice. And here's the paradox. The marks of Jesus' crucifixion were exhibited in a resurrected man. The marks of his death were now seen in a resurrected body. Here, the lesson that Thomas had to learn was of that death that can lead to life. There's the paradox. And Jesus said, and by the way, did Thomas ever reach thither his finger and touch the nail holes? Did he take his hand and thrust it into the side of Christ? No, he didn't, did he? But he said, unless I do that, I will never, never believe. He never, ever did say what he said he was going to do, did he? He believed anyway. And in verse 29, Jesus said unto him, Thomas, because thou hast seen me, thou hast believed. Blessed are they that have not seen and yet have believed. And of course, here we have in verse 29, the last of the Beatitudes, isn't it? Blessed are they that have not seen and yet have believed. And that includes us, because here we have a group of people that never have seen the man with the wounded hands, who never have seen the resurrected Lord, but we believe that he was resurrected because of our understanding of the Father's purpose in the Son. And we know that God had a responsibility to raise him from the dead because of the purity of his life and the perfection of his obedience. And we know that Christ was raised, but we've never seen him. And we didn't need to see him, like Thomas. Blessed are they who have not seen and yet have nevertheless believed. So you see, Thomas had to learn a little bit about sacrificial death, didn't he? The whole of this story focuses on death. Let us go that we may die with him. We know not the way of death that you're going in. And now finally a dead man walks in to confront him. But the dead man isn't dead, he's alive. And the death of Christ was actually a positive thing. All positive. And that was quite foreign to Thomas's thinking. But he had to learn that, didn't he, in order that his character might be changed. Come over to John chapter 21. To 21. That we had some disciples who went fishing. Oh, by the way, perhaps before Mark chapter 3. Just see whereabouts Thomas fits in the record. So in Mark chapter 3 and verse 16, here's our order again. Now this is Mark's order, isn't it? So where does he place Thomas? Well, we've got Peter, verse 16, James and John, verse 17, Andrew 4, Philip 5, Bartholomew 6, Matthew 7, Thomas 8. So Thomas is number 8 in the record. Come back to Matthew's Gospel, Matthew chapter 10. Matthew 7, Thomas 8. Alright, now in Matthew chapter 10 we have Matthew's order. Now the names of the 12 apostles are these. The first, Simon, is called Peter, and Andrew his brother, James the son of Zebedee, and John his brother, that's 4. Philip 5, Bartholomew 6, Thomas 7, and Matthew 8. What's the difference between Matthew and Mark? Thomas is number 8 in Mark, and what number is he in Matthew? He's number 7. And who's number 8 now in Matthew? Who's number 8 in Matthew's Gospel? Who's number 7 in Mark's Gospel? Matthew. So you see what's happened. You see, when Matthew writes his own Gospel, he was actually paired to go off with Thomas, and of course, being the modest sort of chap he was, he swapped it round and put Thomas ahead of himself. But in fact, when you read Mark and Luke, it's clear that Matthew was number 7, Thomas was actually number 8. But when Matthew writes his own Gospel record, he says, oh well, you know, and he puts Thomas ahead of himself, which is what we'd expect. It's one of those little touches, isn't it, that gives us the proof that Matthew really was the writer of Matthew. One of those little secret signatures that tells us that Matthew was the... Now come and have a look at John chapter 21. So Thomas is always about number 7 or 8 in the record, whichever one we take. Now come and have a look at John chapter 21, and we're told in verse 1, after these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, and on this wise showed he himself. There were together Simon Peter, and Thomas called Didymus, and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee, and two other of his disciples, who I believe were Andrew and Philip. But where was Thomas? Why, he's number 2. Now that's a big change. You see what that's telling us? It's telling us that here's the disciples all gathered together, and Thomas was amongst them. But you see, Thomas wasn't just there. He was there. You see, this is a changed man. He's right up near the top of the list now. He's right in the midst of it all. He's a changed man because he's the man now who's seen the resurrected Christ and has seen someone who's broken the power of death. How could that ever be? And if God's got the power to raise a dead body from the grave, then why hasn't God got the power to work in my life as well? Thomas is beginning to understand the secret of God manifestation. And so they all decide to go fishing. And how many fish do they catch? The answer is that to start with, they catch nothing until what happens? Until Christ gives them direction. And the lesson of John 21, of course, is that toil in one's own strength brings nothing, but under Christ's direction is fruitful. And the lesson that Thomas needed to learn from John chapter 21, and listen to this in terms of the words of a pessimist. A pessimist focuses on what he can't do. Here's the lesson for Thomas. I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me. Where does that come from, by the way? Philippians chapter 4, quite right. I can do all things through Christ. And that's the lesson that Thomas had to learn. And of course in Acts chapter 1, which is the very next chapter, is Thomas there? Yes, he is, because in Acts chapter 1 and verse 13 we're told, and when they were come in, they went up into an upper room where abode both Peter and James and John and Andrew and Philip and Thomas. So in fact Thomas is number 6 even in this record. He's definitely moved up a rung or two from where he was when the order of the apostles started off, and he's there in Acts chapter 1. So you see what that tells us. Thomas was a witness of the crucified Christ. Thomas was a witness of the resurrected Christ. Thomas was a witness of the ascended Christ. He saw it all. Thomas saw the whole story. He needed to. It's exactly what Thomas needed. To give him the faith and the conviction to walk out and to become someone who is courageous for the truth, despite his own feelings of inadequacy and doubt and uncertainty that plagued him. He was by nature a pessimist. But he was given the secret here to learn to trust in the strength of the Father and in the power of the Word and in the power of prayer, to lift himself up and above his own inabilities to do what he felt he could never in fact do in his own strength. He could through Christ. You know, you can just imagine, Thomas, can't you, you know, in some of those incidents in the record. Remember when they came through the village of the Samaritans and the Samaritans refused to receive them for the night? Remember that? John said, "So would you like us to blast them to pieces with fire?" I can just imagine Thomas saying, "Yeah, we shouldn't have come this way. Thought we'd have problems. We should never have come through the area of the Samaritans. It was the wrong thing to do." You see Thomas saying that? Or a certain episode when Peter hops out on the boat to walk to Christ, and the wind comes and the waves go up and Peter begins to sink and there's a shriek. I can just see Thomas back in the boat saying, "Should never have got out of the side of the boat. Never would have got me out there. Knew he'd sink. Thought that would happen." There was another occasion when they fed 5,000, remember, in the days of Philip and Andrew and the loaves and fishes. And they, remember, all the disciples went round with a basket to collect up the fragments. Remember, they all collected I can just imagine one of them coming up to Thomas saying, "Look, I've got a basket half full of fragments already." Thomas looks and says, "No, it's not, it's half empty." Pessimists always focus on the negative, don't they? Thomas couldn't help himself. He was just made that way. Now, there are some people like that in ecclesial life. Let's have a gospel proclamation effort. "Oh, well, I don't know if we've got the resources to do that. I don't know if we've got time. I don't know if we've got the money. You think it's the right time to do it, really? Let's do this, let's do that. Oh, well, I'm not sure about that, you know. What about we invite all these people from..." "Oh, well, have we got enough seats? Will there be enough food?" You know, there's some people who always focus on the negatives in ecclesial life. They're pessimists, aren't they? Now, the truth's designed to change us from that. The truth is designed to make us look on the positive side of life. Not because we trust in our own abilities. Thomas would never ever do that. You see, Peter had a problem, didn't he? Peter was too confident in his own abilities. Thomas would never be like that. Thomas always distrusted his own abilities by nature. But what he had to learn was that there is a way of trusting in God and of relying on the strength of the Word and on the comfort of our fellow disciples to help us to do things that we might not have been able to do ourselves. Thomas had to learn those lessons. And he must have learned, because he's one of those 12 that went out and, in the words of Acts, turned the world upside down and, we believe, lost his life preaching the truth. Good old Thomas. He lost his life. He ended up offering his life as a sacrificial death for the truth. He was a martyr for the truth. Imagine Thomas doing that. So he must have been changed, mustn't he? He must have been changed by the experience of the one that we come, in fact, to remember this day, the one that we will commemorate in bread and wine this morning. The man with the wounded hands, who said to Thomas, "Thomas, reach hither thy fingers and behold my hands, and reach hither thy hand and thrust it into my side, and be not faithless, but faithful." Thomas, blessed are they who have not seen and yet have believed.